Racing
on Off the Ball.
And they're off.
Brought to you by Go Racing. Plan your day at the races at goracing.ie.
Now, the flat racing season is in full swing, and of course, we're about halfway through Royal Ascot at this stage. So, I thought, what better time, what better way to look back on the history of racing, particularly in this country, and then with a man who knows a lot about history himself. It's Associate Professor from UCD, author, journalist, part time GEA manager, Paul Rouse joins us in studio. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
To get into horse racing in Ireland, because I guess horse racing in general, we kind of think of in sporting terms, people might even think of like Ben Hur kind of stuff, or like chariot races and all that kind of stuff. And it does have, I guess, its roots back in those times. But just looking at the formal kind of genesis of horse racing in this country, fair days and pattern days seem to be, and especially seeing the summer is kind of upon us now, supposedly, at this stage, they would have been happening big time around this time of year, and that's essentially where it was born as a sport over here.
Well, you can go back as far as you want
variation of what you want.
Exactly. If you want a written record, you can extend right back through the evidence that survives from the medieval period of races between people, say, for example, in the old Talchin games, there are records of races which extend back into the period, even in the early Christian period and all of that. But there are only little pieces of evidence from those years. Although in every single culture that we have a record from where there are horses, people have raced horses against each other. And they have raced horses against each other out of competitive instinct between the horses and between the people racing the horses, and competitive instinct from people who gamble on them. Mm. So throughout all the records, you go back into the Greeks and the Romans, etc. There is no civilization for which there are not horses for which we don't have a record of that.
And gambling seems intrinsic to it, going back to year dot, essentially.
People have gambled about everything. Mm. That, again, insofar as we know of these things, gambling is part of cultures right from the beginning. It seems to be something that is there, but it's particularly attached to horse racing.
Yeah.
And racing for stakes, actually. Racing for stakes. So it was a form of gambling. My £100 says that my horse is going to beat your horse, Richie.
That's essentially where the term steeplechase is born as well. Because people might go, what's steeplechase? What are they actually achieving here, jumping over these fences? And people might have thought that it might have had an association with jumping over fences. But no, you think of steeples, you think of churches, and that's
it's a race between two churches in Cork in the 1750s. And the name, according to the record, is that's where it came from. But if you look at the fair days and the pattern days that you were talking about, I suppose they're two very different things. Mm. So if we look at what a fair day was basically something that extends back, something that was organised, the sale of goods and services at a particular place on a weekly, a monthly or an annual basis, depending on the size of the fair. So you could have fairs in country towns that would happen once a week, and the remnants of those fairs still survive in certain country towns. And then you would have big annual fairs in an area. And I suppose the most famous one of these fairs was the Donnybrook Fair, which was based in the area around where the rugby pitch is, but across into where the church is. So it's kind of spanned the river area in Donnybrook. And it is a fair which survived until after the famine, but had been there from the 13th century.
I love the tale of the Donnybrook Fair, because the term has been borrowed now, obviously, by a chain of shops, and the chain of shops are where you can go and buy a sandwich.
Nothing could be more inappropriate
for like
to the
£9, and you can get your pink lemonade and all this kind of stuff. Whereas rioting was kind of, you know, abound in the Donnybrook Fair back in the day, and just general misbehaviour associated with whatever was going on officially within the fair.
Where the Donnybrook Fair is really interesting is the fact that it was the edge of the city. It was outside the boundary of the city, and as people came out, it's a rural area, people came out to have a fair, and it was a sale place for agricultural goods and everything that happened around it. But it developed into a kind of a festival where there were drinking tents, and it was all manner of debauchery happened. There were, if you go forward to into the 18th century, Trinity students used to go out there from the college, and students were disciplined for some of their behaviour at it.
So you're saying is Donnybrook Fair essentially was the lecture picnic for the 1600s?
Yes, in its own way. Yeah. So you go out there, and there was cockfighting at those fairs, and there was faction fighting, and there were tents where people basically had cudgel play, as what it was called. Cudgel play is basically stick fighting between two individuals. There were boxing matches, and there were horses race between people. And it's this is a society where the horse is fundamental to life, because this is a pre-mechanized era, and the horse is what people use to plow ground and to travel. And it's something that's, again, something that's intrinsic to how life worked during that period.
And the spread out from the city is, I guess, something that's tied into why the Curragh was essentially, you know, used as a focal point for racing pretty much from the 1700s onwards.
It is. There are a load of reasons why the Curragh was used. So first of all, it's commonage.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's not owned by any particular individual means that you can stage races on it at particular times. And it was a contested space between people who wanted a grey sheep on it or people who later wanted to build railways across it and all of those things. But commonage was something that was found in many parts of the country, and you would often have pattern days held on commonage in various towns and villages across Ireland. And the record of those show... basically, it's a local holiday.
Yeah, you mentioned the difference between pattern days and fair days. What was the difference?
So the difference is that the fair day is a largely economic endeavour which has a lot of leisure activities around it. The pattern day is like, its pattern is a corruption of patron, which is patron saint, which is a local holy day.
Right.
And many areas had their own pattern days back through the century. Some of them still survive. In my own home place in Offaly, there's the pattern of St. Columba on the 9th of June every year. And on those pattern days, people from the area took a day off and they came together. They came together for sports, they came together for drinking, they came together for dancing. And one of the ways in which they enjoyed sport was to engage in various forms of horse entertainment. So in Lough Owel, for example, in Westmead, they used to have swimming races between horses. And part of the challenge was the horse would go pretty crazy when it's in the water, and the jockey would have to stay aboard the horse as it goes along. So that's one of the things that they used to do. They used to race horses in various places. Say, for example, in Clahan, vaulting over horses was one of the big things. And in Glanamore, in Donegal, in the north end of Donegal, they used to race horses.
When you say vaulting over horses...
Well, this is one of those things that survive. These are stories that survive, and to know exactly what that is not clear.
Right.
But they appear to try to jump the horse, but that's not...
Like Evel Knievel on the bus from Wembley.
But it may also have been jumping horses over other things. I mean, it's not exactly clear.
I like the idea of the buses in Wembley, Evel Knievel style thing. Somebody gets a pole vault shtick, runs up.
Well, if you think the other sports that were going on, that will of course fit. So you had, for example, shin kicking competitions where you stand in front of
still goes on,
and you had stuff like grinning competitions where the person who could make the ugliest face at each other would win. And these, they have a slippery pole. So the slippery pole is this pole that basically extends up into the air, big thick wooden pole, and there's a whole lot of grease and oil put on it, and the idea is that you get up. So it's sport, but it's not really sport. It's fun as much as anything else.
It's basically the, I don't know if you remember the indoor games from the 70s as presented by Fred Drummond. He'd have a bunch of like shove halfpenny and billiards and all that kind of stuff.
And it's exactly from that tradition, and it's about, because of course people are drinking and eating as the day goes on, this is something that probably adds itself to the gaiety of the day.
The social aspect of it really did help it to, I guess, crystallise as a sport in and of itself, to move away from being involved in fair days and pattern days to being a sport. We see the Turf Club initially being founded by a coffee house or inside a coffee house by the Curragh in the mid-1700s. Similarly, over in Newmarket, there's a weird kind of time-space thing going on where almost within like a couple of decades of each other, there same things happened in the same type of environment. There was another coffee house over in Newmarket that essentially bought the Turf Club over there. Why was it these social areas? Why were these the kind of places that the association nature of it was born?
Well, I suppose there's a range of different things there. The first point is that we like to think that our world is entirely different than worlds that went before and much better.
Yeah.
But that's obviously not always the case, and not often the case, or possibly even not ever the case. And in this instance, the idea of coffee being drunk is ubiquitous now in Ireland, but there were coffee houses being built in Ireland from, if you go back to Dublin from the 1690s, and through the 18th century, it spread across the country into, like, down to Limerick, across into Ennis. So small towns had their own coffee houses. So that's the first thing. So Ireland is part of a globalised world in the sense of the British Empire and European culture. So there's an exchange of culture which happens during those years. That's the first point. The second point of it is, another thing that matters during these years, particularly through the 1700s, is the idea of forming clubs. So there's nothing new about people playing sport. People have played all manner of sport, from kicking a ball with their foot to hitting a ball with a stick and so on. Again, back as far as we have a record. But what was different from the 1700s onwards is that people decided to do it in clubs. They began to make clubs. So the first sports club in Ireland was in 1720, was the Royal Yacht Club in Cork. And that later on there was a rackets club there. So, and it began slowly to increase the number of clubs through the 1700s and then took off in the 1800s. So there were two things that happened. But the third thing that really mattered during this period was that royalty became intrinsically involved with the organisation of horse racing. And it mattered because it happened in England. When Charles II came back to the throne of England in 1660, he was utterly devoted to horse racing. Mm. So he moved his royal court every year at some point to Newmarket. And he founded through Act of Parliament the King's Plate, a race which is still run for in Newmarket in the 1760s. And he actually was the jockey on a horse that won that plate in 1671. Mm. And he kind of created this culture around horse racing, which was there before a club was founded. So this idea of racing horses, and he took this on. And he spread it in a formal sense into Ireland. Because what he did was he funded the establishment of a King's Plate race at the Curragh in 1670. And then he gave, or later on, the Down Royal Corporation was founded in Downpatrick in County Down, where there was a 3 mile kind of loop track about a mile outside the town in the hills there, which became the Down Royal Corporation. And it's still a huge centre of breeding, and breeding comes from that. And actually, William of Orange, when he became king, gave a plate for racing from 1695. So royalty was involved in it.
You mentioned empire there, and you mentioned obviously the close proximity of royalty to the general running of racing and how it was spread and the patronage of it. It's something that obviously, like, we're in the middle of Royal Ascot. It continues today. But I was saying to you off air before we started, like, when you think about, say, football or soccer in this country, its growth in this country is defined by its relationship or lack thereof with the GEA and with a sense of Irishness and the fact that it's always been viewed as something other, the garrison game, it was always called. Whereas horse racing has always had that direct involvement since, as you mentioned, the late 1600s and Charles II, with royalty and with empire. And it doesn't seem to have ever had the same level of issue. We're jumping ahead, but to get to like the early 1920s, when obviously the country was forming its own independence, there were obviously state or country houses and big homes essentially burnt down, but that wasn't because of racing. Racing existed in this own little bubble that seemed completely unaffected by almost everything around it.
It's really interesting what happened with horse racing during the Irish Revolution. And what's interesting is that this was a shared sport across the islands. So Irish horses going over to compete on English tracks, and Irish trainers and Irish jockeys going across to be there. And the stars in Ireland were the stars in Britain when it came to tracks. And there was a huge amount of respect for Irish horses and for everything that was there. And when the war broke out in 1914, there was a stop put to horse racing in England. And of course, then conscription was introduced. So what happened? You then get a decamping of a whole load of English jockeys and horse owners and horses who now come to Ireland, where horse racing was continued during this period. Now, they said it was for breeding purposes and to maintain the equine stock, but essentially they kept the sport going during this period. And during those 4 years of the war, there were a whole load of fundraising events that were established to raise funds for the troops abroad or for disabled soldiers who'd come home from war. And you think, and they got special permission for this from General Macready, who was the commander of the British forces, who pretty bloodily put down the 1916 rising. And he became involved in the horse racing world and everything to do with it. And he gave them permission to keep racing. And on the Easter Monday of the rising, there were a huge amount of British Army officers who were down at the races on that particular day, which left a huge opportunity for the rebels, which they didn't quite seize. But so this was there. So that's absolutely fundamental to the British establishment. But the minute the War of Independence ends, the minute the truce is signed, there was a flip, and the horse racing bodies in Ireland now start holding fundraising events for Republican prisoners and for people who are, so they keep
the fundraisers for the IRA soldiers essentially in Phoenix Park and stuff.
And this is it. So this is a thing. We are something that transcends politics. This is something that we can do because we see a bigger picture here, and our we're given to the horse.
Like reading about it from its very inception over here, you kind of get the pretty much every ladder of the social strata is involved or has an interest in it and will attend races. Is that something that has, I guess, kept it away from that attrition? I'm not sure what's the word I'm looking for here. Kind of the opposing nature of the different strata of society, essentially, is that everybody's involved. That it's a communal thing. That everybody can be involved in this thing. That it doesn't lend itself to one side warring against the other.
We always say hurling is often referred to as Ireland's national game. All the way through the 19th century, though, everybody said that horse racing was Ireland's national sport. That this was the sport that drew everyone together. And if you go back through the 1700s and the 1800s, and organised race days, which become increasingly important in country towns, in villages, everything that happened around there, on those tracks, there is a unity of interest in horse racing. Now, that's not to confuse it to say it was classless. Mm. It wasn't classless. You needed a certain amount of property and a certain amount of title to own a horse and to run a horse in particular races. So there is stratification within the sport. But at the sport itself, what happens is a day out. It is fundamentally a day out for people who go there for drinking. They go there for to see the horses run. And they go there for a kind of a sense of sociability around everything and to gamble.
Again, it comes back to the gambling. There was brilliant pieces by, or notes by Johann George Cole, the travel writer, who wrote his time in Kilkenny. And he wrote about the social aspect of it. And there's some marvellous passages about this in the notes he gave. He said, at a short distance from the course, behind a hill, a city of tents was erected where every earthly desire an Irishman could form might be gratified. These tents were all long and large, all constructed in the same manner. An alehouse in front, a large room with benches and tables in behind, and in the middle, a dancing floor. This dancing floor generally consisted of a door or planks fastened together like a door and placed over a hole in the ground so as to render it more elastic under the feet of the dancers, who were usually four in number and jumped about to their heart's content, almost completely oblivious to the fact that there was a racing event going on beside them as well. But it became this massive day out, as you mentioned, for pretty much everybody.
It's like the streets of Kilkenny on a Saturday night. There's people out there. There's revelry everywhere. But that story is repeated at horse race meeting after horse race meeting across the country. And look at it. By the 1770s, in Tuam, there was a six-day festival of racing in Tuam was started in 1767. In Mallow, it started in 1777.
Yeah.
So this is not just an occasional event. This is something that is happening across the country, across multiple days, and an industry developed around it. And that industry is pretty extraordinary to watch grow. So you have a racing calendar that was established and printed from the 1790s onwards. You have the Turf Club. Yeah. You have a jockey club, first of all, that was established in 1750s in a restaurant on Dame Street called the Rose and Garter. It lasted 20 years, moved to the Curra, then moved to a coffee house in Kildare Town. And it was based there, tried to establish its writ across horse racing in Ireland, and utterly failed. Because why would you give in to it? If you run a local horse racing meeting, why should you somehow kowtow to the stewards of the Turf Club just because they say they're the governing body?
Yeah.
Why would you bother? The Turf Club folded in the Jockey Club folded in the 1770s, become the Turf Club then began to take over in the 1790s, and the story of the next 100 years is the story of the writ of the Turf Club slowly extending across almost all but not every flat race meeting across the country.
Yeah. One of the interesting facts that that came from reading your notes as well was, obviously you mentioned industry, and through industry you kind of need travel to get around. Like initially the horses had to go from, essentially they walked from meeting to meeting, whereas the expansion of the railways happened almost in lockstep with, you know, them being posted close to race courses. And that happened pretty much all around the country. And the fact that this happened as well, almost in the middle of the famine, which seems incredible to look back upon. People kind of might have this remote idea of the famine as being, you know, destitute people heading for the docks and trying to get out of the country as soon as they can. But there was still burgeoning stuff going on in the country. The railways was one of them. And the fact that it was done almost in lockstep with racing seems fascinating to me.
It is absolutely the case. Absolutely the case. that people were leaving the country destitute during the famine. The raw details of what happened during those years are undeniable. It was an appalling time for a whole lot of other people, but no country is any one thing at any given time. Yeah. And what was happening across those years was the completion of the railways across various sections of the country. So you get the spread, for example, in 1848, right in the heart of the famine, of the extension to Limerick Junction and to Thurles. You get the racetracks then begin to emerge all around. If you look at principal train stations all around the country, look at how close a racetrack is established to it, and look how sidings are built. For example, there's a special station built at the Curragh to bring people to the races in the Curragh, and of course a new stand is built in 1853. In 1874, when Baldoyle racecourse is opened with the train going out, there are 10,000 people at the races. Special trains are put on, so the two begin to work in concert with each other. Free travel is given to horses on the railways to bring them to various places. And then tickets are sold on racing specials, basically special trains brought on.
Put on for the races.
Put on for the races to bring punters there. And that's how it works.
And it's a symbiotic relationship as well, because the rail companies then start sponsoring races to kind of...
They sponsor races, and they do it, by the way, for other sports as well. The Railway Cup comes from, obviously, from railways sponsoring GAA matches. And this is something railways understand straight away, the growing importance of sport in the late 19th century.
Is that the first kind of instance of races being sponsored by the railway companies in this country? Or
people put up stakes for money on a local basis, but in terms of an industry.
Well, in terms of Dublin Draw to railways, like sponsoring, you know.
Yes, exactly. It comes basically from that. And it's a relationship in which they both benefit, and they both make so much from it. And crucially, journalists also now travel on the railways.
Yeah, they've this means of getting about, this means of covering races, and there's a certain level of celebrity comes with journalism as well. As I'm sure you know, comes with journalism too. This guy Lux, who was a pretty prominent racing writer and sports writer in general in this country, he was one of the first people to kind of strap on the reins to this thing and ride it for all it was worth, and he became one of the best known tipsters in the country.
He became so 1873, the first weekly newspaper dedicated only to sport was set up in Ireland. It's joined in 1880 by another newspaper, which was kind of, I suppose, imaginatively enough, called Sport, which was a weekly newspaper published in Dublin. And Lux got a job writing for Sport, offering tips, but also writing reports of the meetings. And he's contrary. He writes brilliantly, but he's a crank. He gives out if he doesn't get his way. And week after week, he boasts.
He would do brilliant numbers on Twitter.
He would, but Barnford. Yeah. But every single week, he writes, if you had backed my tips last week, you would have made X amount of money.
Yeah.
And again, all around the newspapers are ads for stables, ads for whips, ads for saddles. So there's a whole industry grew up around the newspapers, who again now work with race meetings around the country, and they work together because, of course, again, that's mutually beneficial, and it's a triangulation between the railways, the newspapers, and the sport, as they all boost each other and they all make more money from it.
And it seems that it's once you get that kind of, and it happens, I guess, with any industry, once you have those kind of relationships going, things are only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and you see the courses are able to build bigger grandstands. You mentioned the Curragh was able to upgrade in the mid-1800s, and there are other race courses down around the country are able to do the exact same. And you almost have this Lux is kind of looking down on, say, smaller race meetings or newer ones, is kind of go, well, that doesn't really count. That
doesn't really wash. And he goes nuts over a whole variety of different things. So the magistrates in Cork wouldn't give a licence to Cork Park, was a racetrack down in Cork in the 1870s and 1880s. Yeah. And they wouldn't give him a licence to sell drink at the racetrack. And Lux arrived down there and obviously couldn't drink and was appalled. He said it was monstrous that a man, and he always spoke about men, that a man could not go to the races and have a drink. And of course what's happening is that there was an attempt in the late 19th century to improve the general behaviour of people at public events. So there's a change in manners in the 19th century, and that change of manners about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. So you're meant to eat food with cutlery, and you're not meant to urinate in the streets, and you're meant to behave in a very particular way at races, which means no more faction fighting, no more cudgel playing in the backrooms, no more cockfighting. But just because you tell people not to do these things doesn't mean it happens. Just because you introduce a law banning cockfighting at racing, it still goes on.
Yeah.
And it happens all the time.
It's strange the way, like, we've kind of touched upon it a couple of times in this conversation already, is that there's nothing new under the sun. The idea that, like, gambling might be associated with sport goes back to your dot, the sponsorship, obviously, as we mentioned there. And, like, the faction fighting thing, like, because there's been talk, especially in the UK over the past while, of, you know, the behaviour at racecourses needs to improve. There's been several cases of you know, wanton, destructive behaviour, yada, yada, yada. And it almost seems as like, if you're to stamp it out completely, you're to stamp out one of the core traditions of what's gone on with racing over the years.
Well, you have to...
A bad one, probably, but, you know...
It's a bad one, but you see at all of these events, most events pass off with no problems at all, and nothing goes on. People generally go out, and their behaviour is within certain constraints. And then occasionally there's just this extraordinary flare-up. And it's not necessarily to do with the races. The races are just the venue for it.
Yeah.
And that happens time and again. And you can see the manner for all the talk of professionalisation of races and for all the talk that this is an organised modern sport, it still clung on to this notion of a day out with its bars and with its gambling. And an equation which involves drink and money and loads of people wandering around offered the opportunity for things to go wrong, or right, depending on which way you look.
And I suppose as an opportunity for people to use it as well, you know, it's touched upon, it's mentioned still, the amount of funding that horse racing would get from a government level. And we've, you know, there's another strand of that as well, whereby, you know, governments want to court an audience that might attend races. Like, you look at the tents at the Galway races, etc., etc. That's a whole other conversation you could get into as well, but the politicalisation of it is a big thing too, or can be.
No, it's kind of interesting. The racing board that was set up in Ireland in the 1940s has done phenomenal work in its various guises since. But there's a fascinating thing on it. W.T. Cosgrave, who had a really difficult relationship with Eamon de Valera, to put it mildly, after the Civil War of the 1920s, was asked by de Valera's government to sit on the racing board, and he agreed. It was the one time in which he agreed to go and work on this. So racing seemed to be a place where it was okay to participate because it was government but not really government. But the state made a decision to pour a whole lot of money, and has done for decades, into horse racing because it's both an industry and a sport. And it created a world around it, and equine exports are worth a lot of money to the country. And even in the depths of recession, it's not just the state in terms of government departments or who give money to horse racing, various aspects of horse racing. It's even local government. Like, look, in 2013 and 2014, this state and services were in collapse. And yet Dunleary Rathdown Corporation, or Council, County Council, were given a total of 80 grand across 2 years as prize funds for horse racing in Leopardstown. So the connection, these things are, so there's money given for prizes for that.
Yeah.
There's grants given for the building of grounds. There's money put into various facilities around the place. There's obviously tax issues and rebates and everything that comes with being involved in a professional sport. And all of that is there.
It's a deep, deep rooted thing. The one thing that kind of struck me was it back in the early 1900s, 1913, I think, was one of the notes you had here. There were 54 courses around the country, and that dropped to, I think, 26 in modern times. Is that simply a distilling of it, in that the best kind of survive, and the bigger courses, your Punchestowns, your Leopardstowns, your Curras, your whatever, your Gorham Parks, are able to keep regular business going, whereas the other ones are so intermittent and can't necessarily attract the big races, it can't attract the big horses or the big sponsors you mentioned there, that they kind of slipped away a little bit?
It's a natural thing that happens in sport, that sports rise and fall, and they change form, and the nature and how they're organised shifts over time. And it happened in horse racing. It happens differently in different sports. Like, for example, golf has continued to grow and grow with the number of courses, increasing decade after decade from the 1880s onwards. And in other sports, there's a rationalisation of where events take place, because, of course, it's really hard to keep a club going. It takes a lot of effort on behalf of people to keep a club going. And in the case of racing, of course, there's another issue. it's incredibly valuable real estate in very many ways. Mm. So look at what happened, for example, with the Phoenix Park racecourse. That was sold, you know, more than 30 years ago. And again, exceptionally valuable land in a very particular place. There is an attraction there for people to sell on. So there's the difficulty in keeping something going, and the opportunity to make something else of it is important to any sport.
But it seems like one of the, like, you never really hear of, this is probably a completely tangential point altogether, but you never hear, like, GAA is famed for the discussions and for the gripes about how the GAA is run, how the FAI is run, how, you know, Swimming Ireland is run, how, you know, the OCI is run. Horse racing Ireland and horse racing in this country in general seems to be this little thing, as you mentioned, it exists in its own little bubble. And I know, I'm sure there are people listening to this who will have their complaints about it, but it seems like it's been consistently remarkably well run in this country, which is a complete anomaly for literally anything else in this country, which doesn't happen to get the same smooth running.
Well, it is first and foremost, I think, a business.
Yeah.
And it's run on a localised level by business people who have their yards, and they run it that way. And it does get a huge amount of money from the state as a sport. Now, how it's run beyond that, and it's the success in which it's run, because we don't know, and I cast no aspersions here when I say this, because we don't know it, there are issues in the governance of every sport.
Yeah,
I would suggest, if you really lift up the stone and have a look under it. And as you say, if you talk to people who are intimately involved in it, I'm certain that they have gripes. There is nothing that people do together that doesn't lead to some sort of tension or disagreement or dispute.
Once it doesn't lead to cudgel fighting and shin kicking, I think it'll be okay.
Well, it has had its issues, even for example of drugging in horse races, and how drug testing works, and that extends not something new. That's something that extends back well into the late 19th century into the early 20th century.
It's a fascinating, like, there's so many different aspects of it I could probably get into it, but we only have a limited amount of time. But Paul Rouse, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks a million, pleasure.
Our racing coverage, of course, is brought to you by goracing.ie. We'll have more after this.
Racing
on Off the Ball,
and they're off.
Brought to you by Go Racing. Plan your day at the races at goracing.ie.